Welcome to the Connect You podcast, where we interview guests who have transformed their lives, whether in mind, body, health, or wealth. Connect You seeks to discover what drives people and makes them extraordinary. Brought to you by Lewis Jackson, who brings you exciting real-life stories, hot topics, and the truth.
Welcome back to the Connect You podcast. On today's episode, we have James Sahota, or most of you will know him as Uncle James.
That's right.
I normally introduce people, but this man needs no introduction. James, I'll let you do the intro.
Oh, thank you, mate. You're too kind. Yeah, it's been a while since I've done a podcast with anyone. In fact, I used to host my own podcast show, which is just having a little bit of a break at the moment. So when you said, do you want to come on the podcast? I was like, yeah, do you know what? I've missed being on a podcast for a while. Even though I was the host, I thought, let's be on the other side this time and see what it's all about. So yeah, mate, no, thank you so much for inviting me on. And it just worked so fantastically because I was in the area. And yeah, really happy to be here, mate.
Thank you so much, mate. And like I say, guys, if you haven't checked it out, what's the name of your podcast, just quickly?
It's the J2 Hub podcast. So we finished up series one, which got to about, I think, just under 100 episodes. And I took a bit of a break from it for various reasons. But series two is coming back, and it's going to be more of a Dubai edition this time. So, yeah, watch out for that.
Wicked. Now, as you just touched on Dubai, for anyone that doesn't know, James is a father, a husband, obviously a son. Now, he also invests in property, as you all know. And if you don't know, I suggest you go and check out the socials. But he recently moved to Dubai.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're a real estate agent.
Mm-hmm.
I normally do these podcasts in a way which we start at the beginning, but with yourself, it's special. Let's start the other way around.
Right.
Now, okay. You're in Dubai.
Yeah.
Why have you moved from the UK to Dubai?
So, I think one of the main reasons I moved out there was, like, my sister lives there, and my nephew and niece are there. And when my nephew and niece were born, they kind of just left. They went. So, I never really had a relationship with them. And when my sister suggested, why don't you come out here to Dubai, be close to your family, I thought, you know what? It's a good time, you know. And having lost my mum, I thought, I don't really need to be around in London anymore, because I was kind of situated in London to be close to my mum so that I could look after her. And then, yeah, when she passed away, I thought, you know what, this is a good time to get out there. And I always knew Dubai was happening, and there's a lot of things going on in Dubai. Dubai is a very exciting place, and it is completely bonkers, like people say it is. You know, it's off the radar. But for me, I was getting too comfortable here in the UK. I don't know if you, like, how can I describe it? So everything I was doing was becoming quite easy, and it was becoming so comfortable that I felt I wasn't growing anymore. You know, every few months you buy another property, you convert it into HMO, you refinance it, you add a few more £1,000 onto your income each month. And yeah, it was good, don't get me wrong, but it was just like, it almost became a bit of a 9-to-5. You knew all the steps. There was nothing exciting about it anymore. And I just thought, in order for me to grow, I've got to get uncomfortable, you know. And Dubai, I knew, was going to get me uncomfortable in a big way, because it's a cultural shock for starters. Just the way people are out there, the way business is done out there. So yeah, I wanted to, my main reason was be close to my family and get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
And now that you're out there.
Yeah.
Are you comfortable again? Obviously, I know that you're succeeding out there, but for anyone that's listening, what is it you're doing out there?
So my game plan out in Dubai is eventually I want to have my own brokerage, I think, and I want to get into construction. Basically, what I do out here, I want to do in Dubai. Now, Dubai is a place where they don't really believe in refurbing properties. So when something gets old, they just leave it, or they knock it down, or they build something new. So they don't have this concept of, you know what, we've got a perfectly good building here, let's refurb it and do something with it. And I think that's where I've maybe spotted a little bit of a loophole or a little bit of an entry there, where you can buy bigger villas in places where it's desirable to live, but those villas are now so dated that they don't appeal to people. So they're not making that maximum amount of money that they used to in the past. And I think there's an opportunity to go in there and add value. And, you know, like you do here, the old BRR, do the same thing there. So I thought, let's go out there and explore it in a place where property is just bonkers. You know, there's so much of it out there. There's never going to be a shortage of trying to find a deal, because they're just everywhere. So yeah, my goal in Dubai is to have my own property business out there. At the moment, I'm working with a fantastic firm. I think they're just absolutely awesome, one of the best out there. So it's great to be associated with someone who's teaching me the ropes and, you know, allowing me to really succeed. But yeah, eventually I think I'd like to get into construction.
Wicked, boy. I mean, would it be fair to say that through your years of doing it in the UK, mm-hmm. you've had to sacrifice a lot?
Yeah, absolutely, mate, absolutely. Even now, you know, it doesn't get... Like I say, it gets easier, but then there's times when you're waiting for a bank valuation or you're thinking, is this thing gonna value up? Or you go into a site and you think, shit, man, this needs a new roof and I didn't account for that. You've ripped off the floors and you think every single joist in this place is rotten. That's another 10 grand gone by the time you finish. So I think, yeah, you know, there are lots of sacrifices in terms of monetary sacrifices. But I think there's also a lot of family sacrifices as well, because...
That's what I was going to touch on, your wife especially, and your kids.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my wife's a champion, you know, she's a... she might listen to this, so I've got to say good things. But, you know, that old saying where they say behind every good man is a good woman? I totally believe it. She is a great woman, and she's been a great support, you know. So through successes, through failures, everything. Because when I met her, I had nothing. I had zero, you know, so... I know my missus she's seen it all. So she's been there to see all the tough times we've gone through. You know, she's been there when we've been struggling to get a few thousand pounds together to pay for stuff, you know, when we were doing property stuff. So yeah, it's had a massive toll on our relationship. We've been married 15 years. First 5 or 6 years, I'd say, I was hardly around, you know, hardly around. I'm always working. I had my business at that time as well, which took up so much of my time. I almost missed the birth of my first son, you know, which is criminal. So you kind of make up for it with the second child. And now, being in Dubai, for us, it's just all about family. Any free time for me is about family. Because look, at the end of the day, I think when it's all said and done and you're lying there, hopefully not in your deathbed, you know, hopefully you clonk it and that's it, you're gone. You don't go through any long suffering. But when you're sitting there going through suffering, you're not thinking about, oh, I wish my valuation comes back higher, or I wish I can pull more money out of that deal. You're only wishing for time, and you're only wishing for a little bit of more time so you can spend some time with your loved ones and be there for them. But when you've got the opportunity to do that, when you're alive and kicking, you don't want to do it. But when you get older and it's time to say goodbye, you're asking for more time. So I think for me now, my focus is really switched to creating a lot of memories, being with my family, being with loved ones, just, you know, reaching out to friends that I haven't spoken to for a while, seeing how people are, just giving them a call and saying, hey, look, man, I've seen you've been a bit odd on the social media recently. I've seen some quotes that you've been putting up. Is everything all right? Like, you know, I'm just reading below, you know, above the lines here to see, is everything good with you? Because I think sometimes people try to express themselves through social media to see if anybody would kind of lend a hand. So I think it's very, very important to, you know, touch on that. But before I go off on that tangent, because I know you probably want to talk about that later. But yeah, for me, man, there was loads and loads of sacrifices in the early days, you know, monetary sacrifices, family, friends, time, going to family events. So, yeah.
One thing I certainly want to unpack that you just touched on was obviously your mum. And for anyone that doesn't know, that's all over your social media as well.
Yeah.
I followed that journey. And I think it was such an inspiration what you've done. Your mum passed, she was 65.
She passed, 2 weeks after her 65th birthday, yeah.
No, obviously, because I know you, I knew that.
Mm.
But what do you feel was the biggest challenge for you at that stage in your life?
Do you know what it is, Lewis? One of my biggest fears was always losing my mum. Mm. Always. It's always been my biggest fear in my whole life, because I had a great relationship with my mum. It was fantastic, you know, and I'm not afraid to say I was a mummy's boy. You know, I lost my dad when I was 6. So we had a very strong relationship. We had a very, very good relationship. I wanted to spend time with her. I'd ring her almost every day. We'd have a chat about something or the other. But yeah, she was a very, very integral part of my life. So, and it was always my fear. As every year went on, I thought, shit, man, I'm going to have to say bye to her at some point. I'm going to have to say bye to this woman. And that was one of my biggest fears. I was thinking, how the hell am I going to get over this when it happens? And it just so happens, the way it happened for me was... I didn't even have time to think about it, you know. We're there one afternoon she's on site with me and she's all good. She used to love getting involved. If you watch, like you say, if you watch my socials, she'd be around. She used to love getting her hands dirty, get out on site, actively taking interest in every single project. And, you know, she's fit and healthy, doing what she needs to do. And next minute we stop for lunch, we're having a bit of lunch and she's having a fit, you know. And still I'm thinking, nah, I'm thinking in my head, this is a good one, Mum. You're trying to get me here, isn't it? Because we'd always be playing little pranks on each other. But I soon realised, no, she's having a proper fit here. And I think at that moment, it was like a massive weight just drops on you. And I felt it, like a massive weight on my chest. And I just knew she wasn't going to come round from that. Some bizarre reason inside me told me that, look, this is a lot more serious. You don't just have a fit like that if you're perfectly healthy. So I kind of think I accepted at that point, like, she ain't coming back from this, even though she came round and she was all good. And that's still a memory that haunts me. You know, I was talking to an uncle of mine earlier today and I said, I think about that 3 or 4 times a day. You know, it's not gone away. It's still there. It's very, very raw. And if she hadn't been with me, I think, where would she have been? She could have had a fit on the road. She could have fallen down. She could have smashed her head. So I'm kind of thankful she was with me. But yeah, it was very, very hard when that happened. And obviously after that, they took her into hospital and they found a couple of small tumours in her head, in her brain. And, you know, she said to me, she rang me that night. She goes, oh, they found them. They're going to cut them out. I'm going to be all good. Good as new. Because they said to her, look, it's very early. They're very small. We'll cut them all out and you'll be fine. You know? And I was joking around with her. I said, yeah, you know, when they open you up, Mum, get them to give you a little tune-up, give you a little oil change and that, you know. She's like, can you run me in an iPad so I can watch some Netflix? Because she knew she was going to be there for a while. And she come out, she's all ready, she's all dandy. She's like, yeah, I'm ready to go back to work now. I'm all good. Even though they were telling her you can't do much. And then I remember we had to go down to a hospital over in London a few weeks after. They wanted to do some checks on her. And, you know, she's all good. She's ready. She's thinking they're just going to be some checks. So I took her around there. We went down there in a taxi. I remember we got out waiting around. And it was a very, very long wait. And I'm thinking, something's not quite right here. You know, when you know, you're thinking, okay, if this is just a checkup, why is it taking so long? Why is this consultant involved? Why is that consultant involved? Why is this person involved? And I'm thinking inside, yeah, something's not quite right here. So we get in and I won't never forget. It was an Irish doctor, specialist, a lady she was. And, you know, I don't think she meant bad, but she was just quite abrupt, you know. And that time COVID was rife, so you had your face masks on, so your reactions were kind of covered. And I just remember her saying, like, she goes, it's not good news. And I thought, oh, fuck, what's going on here? What do you mean it's not good news? And they just turned around and said to her, said, look, at best, you've got 11 months to live. At best, you've got a very rare form of brain cancer, which is at grade 4. And the way the cells multiply is that they've got hooks, so they just carry on hooking and hooking and hooking. Even if we do chemo and radiotherapy on it, we can kind of reduce it and buy you some more time. But yeah, you're going to die. And it was just like, okay. And I remember my mum, I remember looking over. I've got my mouthpiece on and underneath my lips starting to go. And I'm thinking, shit, I can't burst out in tears in front of her. She's just had the worst news of her life. And she was just so, like, just as I remember her, she was just sitting there like this. And I said to her, I go, Mum, do you know what they're telling you? And she's like, yeah. I just thought, fuck me, this woman is brave. And the woman who was looking after us, I remember the nurse throughout the whole of it, such a lovely lady she was. She said, go and have some time outside, go and have a cup of tea. And, you know, I said to my mum, I said, look, take a seat here and I'll let me get you a cup of tea. And she's like, yeah, okay, get you a cup of tea. And I was like, okay. And I remember walking up at the hospital and I'm phoning my wife and I ring her number and I couldn't get a single word out. And I still remember it. And I'm like, I'm trying to say what's wrong. And my wife knew something was wrong. And she's like, what's the matter, mate? What's wrong? Why are you not saying what you need to say? And I'm trying to tell her, like, this is what they've just said. Could not get my words out, mate. And I remember it was so, so painful. And I walked outside the hospital and I ran into this corner. And that was it. I was just in tears. I was just in tears because I thought, fuck, my biggest fear has come true, you know, and quickly wiped off those tears and went back inside and thought, I can't let her see me like this, you know. She's had the worst news of her life. And I remember the cab journey all the way home. Well, before that, they said they're going to do some chemo radiotherapy. And we're hopeful, thinking, yeah, they might have caught it in time. She, you know, she might be one of these miracle cases. But deep down, you just know that's it. When the C word's said, isn't it? You know, it's just gonna go in the wrong way, really. And you know what? You never think it's going to happen to you. You know, you hear the word cancer all the time. And you hear people dying of cancer. And you're just oblivious to it. You think, nah, fuck that. It's not going to happen to me. So, cab journey home, not much was said. I just held her hand. And then she gets home, and that's when she let it go. You know, she sat on the sofa and she let it go. And every emotion came out of her then. And I just didn't know what to say, you know. And my stepdad came in and they just held each other. And I was like, there was no words. There was no words at all. My sister was 3,500 miles the other side of the earth, and I had to break the news to her. You know, God knows how she took it. I know she was upset, but I don't know how she must have been feeling not having anyone there. Well, she had a husband, but you know. And then I just remember walking out of the house, and then just my friend who owns an off license just walking into his shop, telling him, and you know, I remember for the next 6 months being pretty pissed from morning till evening, you know, and that was just my way of kind of dealing with it. And to be fair to my friend, he was great because he lost his dad through cancer as well. No, he lost his dad through something else. But he said to me, James, you know what? You gotta gear yourself up for this. He goes, because life goes on. And he goes, when your mum eventually goes, the world does carry on going. And I couldn't understand what he meant about that. But later on, I realised what he did mean. And so, anyway, we went through 3 or 4 months of chemo. You know, she's an absolute soldier taking chemo and radiotherapy. I don't know if you've ever seen someone go through chemo or radiotherapy. It really messes them up. Like, you know, I was going up to the hospital. I got to know all the people having chemo and radiotherapy there because I was taking her up to the hospital. And it was it was amazing to see how much fight these people had. And there was a lot of people saying to me towards the end, they go, what, your mum's had 29 sessions? I went, yeah, she's had 29 sessions. One guy goes, I had 5, and I told him, don't give me no more sessions, I'd rather just die. So at that point I thought, shit, this woman is still fighting. Yeah, and just right the way through it, she was a complete soldier. But then, you know, you see the gradual decline. You know, they get weaker, they can't walk. And I remember towards the end, she couldn't talk. She was not eating, nothing at all. And, you know, it was good that I was able to move her into one of our places so she was close to all her family, because that's what she wanted. So, you know, she died peacefully at home. Well, I wouldn't say peacefully, but she died at home with me and my sister with her. I was holding her hand when she took her last few breaths. And, you know, I remember the night before she died, I said, you know what, Mum, I'm big enough and ugly enough to look after myself now. Because I almost felt she was trying to hold on, because she knew she was all about her family. And then when she did take her last few breaths, I held her hand and she went. It's such a surreal feeling. You just, you know, it's almost as if you can see, people say you can see their soul leaving. I'm pretty sure I could see her soul leaving that day. And again, after that, it was just like, what do you do now? I remember I walked out onto the road. I could see the buses moving past and I'm just holding my head thinking, fuck, it's happened. And best way I knew, went straight back round to my mate's shop. And I remember we opened a bottle of whiskey and it was gone within half an hour. Just numbing that pain. And you know what? He was there with me throughout this whole journey. I think it's probably an excuse for him to have a drink. And it probably didn't help that he owned an off license as well. Because this is the time you start drinking and this is the time you stop. It was literally months of just drinking. And then that has an effect on your relationship with your wife, with your children. And then I remember that night, the night she passed away, because the morgue where she was being kept was right near our house, like literally walking distance. Like you come out here, you go around there, funeral director's there. And then we knew she was being stored there. So that was just even more, me and my friend were standing outside there till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, drinking, drinking and saying, why do you have to go? Why do you have to go and leave us? Then it got to a level where it got really, really emotional, you know. He's pissing down with rain and standing in the middle of the rain shouting at the sky saying, the fuck have you gone, you know? And that was kind of like, yeah, probably one of the hardest times of my life. And then I just thought, I can't carry on drinking. Something's got to give, you know. So that's when we stopped and just thought, to be fair to my friend, I said to him, we've got to do something positive. We can't just fucking carry on boozing because we'll be boozing for the whole year. And we both used to enjoy running. And that's when we thought to ourselves, right, that's it, stop. We're going to try and do 250 kilometers in a month, both of us, which meant you had to do about 10, 11 kilometers a day with a rest day. So that's pretty serious. If anybody runs trying to do a 10K every day. And that meant you couldn't drink, because if you were going to drink the night before and then try and go out on a run, you were going to suffer seriously. So, yeah, so we kind of channeled that energy in a different way. We set up a page to raise some money for a charity in India, which raised money for abandoned girls. So in India, there's still this taboo. If you have a daughter, you know, you're cursed and bloody, bloody this. And so children are just dumped at this orphanage. So we thought, let's try and raise some money for that. Yeah, we managed to raise about eight or nine thousand pounds for them. And it meant for the next month, we weren't boozing, which was good. Getting a straight head and just thought, you know what? We've got to crack on, because I'm thinking she wouldn't want me to do this. And if she was alive, she would have given me a flipping slap. So, yeah. So, but yeah, it all happened so suddenly with my mum, mate. It was, she went far too young. You know, she was looking forward to her retirement. And the poor sod didn't make it to her retirement. So, yeah.
I think what you've done, though, is the way you've handled it is... You dealt with the situation like most people would.
Yeah.
And if I know for a fact, if it was my mum, I don't know how I would deal with it, number one.
Yeah.
And if most people say, or if anyone says they know how they would, I don't think that it's an accurate assumption.
Mm.
I personally don't know how I would deal with it. But the way you channeled it, and again, watching you on a social media and knowing you, not the type of person you are, and we'll come on to other failures you've had, and how you've come out the end and knowing you've got that in you, the discipline in you to do it. I think that's absolutely amazing. And
thank you.
No doubt that your mum gave you that attribute, the discipline.
Yeah.
To sort of channel that into something more positive than the drink. One thing I do want to ask is, did you ever feel suicidal throughout that?
No. Because I've got my boys, I've got my kids, I've got my wife. It just wouldn't be, it'd be an easy thing to do, because you could just, it's over, isn't it? It's done. But I always think, like, you know, I know why people do it. I get it. I totally get it. Because I've had some seriously high stress levels and things going wrong. But what if it doesn't go the way you want it to go? You know, what if you think I'm going to jump off this bridge and kill myself and then you just end up crippled? You know, and then I think you've got even more emotions to deal with. No, I'd say to anybody who feels like they need to do that, just ring someone, man. Just ring someone, speak to someone, air it out, have a conversation. Because I'm a strong believer, when somebody reaches out and asks you for help, you might be their last resort. You might be the last person they're thinking of in their time of need. That's why when people message me odd things, I'm always intrigued to find out, okay, what's going on here? Is this guy okay? Is he in the right frame of mind? Does he need 15 minutes on the phone just to perk him up? You know, because...
That's exactly what happened to me. That's why I asked you the question. Now, I wasn't suicidal. For anyone listening, I wasn't suicidal. However, there was a lot going on with myself, my business. The stress levels were through the roof for myself. But I reached out to you.
Mm.
You're the only one that picked up the phone.
I remember.
And it was a case of, you gave me that 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And not all the time, there's not going to happen all the time.
Mm.
But if you pick up the phone and just dial, it's not always going to be that bad.
No.
Like I said, I wasn't, just reiterate the fact, I wasn't suicidal, but I knew that you potentially could have the answer to what I was constantly bashing my head against a brick wall.
Sure.
And you gave me that time. So I think that, knowing what you've gone through, you have to be around the right people, and that for me is massive. And like you said, with your friend, your network is key. in these instances. You've got to surround yourself with the right people.
Absolutely. You know, and I'd say it live on your podcast, if anybody is listening and they think, oh, you know what, I need someone to speak to, message me. Message me, I'll speak to you. Because I'd hate for someone to think, shit, man, all I need is someone to kind of speak to me, to kind of talk me out of doing this, or to help me, or help me see another path, or, you know. But yeah, if anybody, open to it, mate, open to it. Happy to talk to anybody who might be feeling like that.
No, I appreciate it, mate. And then, just going to talk about the property stuff now. So, obviously, I've done a lot of research on you, and then, obviously, going from Dubai, losing your mum, just before that, because we're doing a reverse of your life now.
Yeah.
So, you've just got over that tragic instance with your mum. But you've been dabbling in property.
Yeah.
But you lost your business.
Yeah.
But I want you to talk me through when you first started investing in property, what happened just before that? Tell the listeners what happened before.
Yeah.
Because you've not always been in property.
No.
You didn't start in property.
No, I didn't. No. So I'm actually, believe it or not, I've got 3 degrees. I have a master's degree. I'm actually a qualified teacher as well, so I can teach in any UK school. But I soon realised that, no, it wasn't for me. Like, the whole teaching thing wasn't for me. So I always had a real like for design and creating things. So I set up a print business, actually, going back quite a few years. It was a canvas printing business, so, you know, mounting canvas on bits of wood and selling them. And this was a time when eBay was pretty fresh, Amazon was pretty fresh. So I remember a small little printer I had, I started selling some pictures, and I thought, wow, that's extra 100 quid this week. I thought, you know, that's nice on top of your wages. Then I thought, okay, let's buy a slightly bigger printer. And I thought, okay, that's an extra £1,000 this week. And then I thought, okay, let's buy something else. Let's get a little bit bigger. So, kind of cut a long story short, I kind of went from printing small A4 pictures to having a print firm, which we had a warehouse which was 25,000 square foot. We had about £3 million of a print gear. We bought a 5 meter printing machine, which is £1.5 million. And it was just reinvestment. Now, I ain't going to claim that I knew how to run a business. You know, along those 12 years or whatever it was just good. It was really, really good. You know, I knew how to talk to people. I knew how to create relationships, get clients on board. And we expanded the business really, really quickly. And I remember very early on, I met a guy. I still remember his name, Henry G. Printers over in Hackney. He was the only guy who gave me 10 minutes of his time. I remember him saying, I was knocking on doors trying to speak to people that are running print firms. He goes, yeah, come on in, son. I've got 10 minutes for you. And he's typical, having a smoke in his office. And then he goes to me, he goes, son, there's a couple of lessons I've got for you. He goes, number one, he goes, when someone gives you an opportunity, just say yes. He goes, figure the rest out later on. He goes, whatever they
great,
say.
Great advice.
Yeah. He goes, if they're saying to you, can you do this? Say yes. And then figure out how you want to do it the rest after that. And he goes, number two, son, if you ever think about cheating on your wife, he goes, I can tell you, the grass is not always greener on the other side. He goes, and it's all going to feel the same downstairs. So let me save you some heartache. Don't bother. And there are two things that have stuck with me today, you know, and that's a long time ago. And I find myself saying that to other people now, the older I get. But he gave me an opportunity. So, the print business was really good. I'm not going to lie, mate. It got to a point where spending money like it was going out of fashion, you know. Yeah. You'd go out, you could spend 10 grand in a night out with your friends, and it didn't mean nothing. So I had some wild 20s, late 20s, and then I remember at one point I had 7 cars as well, and it was great. I still think back now, and because it was such a high cash flowing business, there was never a shortage of money. Whether we were thinking about, oh, that bit of money's due for tax, that bit of money's due for that, I don't know, you know, I wasn't the accountant, but I knew one thing, if I wanted to go out and spend money, I could buy my kids whatever, you know, regularly we'd go car shopping a few times a month, and it just wasn't any bother.
Because you like your cars?
Yeah, I do like my cars, yeah, although I don't have one at the moment, if you saw what I was driving in Dubai, because I'm still waiting for my official paperwork to come through, but yeah, I do like cars, yeah. So, always had a nice car, you know, and it was the one thing, but coming back to what you said, sacrifices and time. I never really got to enjoy it because I was still working, always working. If there was a rare Sunday that I pulled my car out, it'd go and fill it up with petrol, give it a boot, and then clean it and put it back in the garage.
Mm.
You know, who has a 911 then and only does 1,200 miles a year? Only an idiot. You know, it spent more time in the garage because brakes were seizing up and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was a good time, man. It always makes me smile thinking about that time because it was like a little baby that we'd grown into a monster, and it did grow into a monster. My exit plan always was for somebody to buy it, you know, for somebody just to buy out the company. And I remember driving over here and seeing Solo Press, signs for Solo Press. And at the time, I really loved their story because I really followed them closely, how those guys had grown that business into a monster. And they were really inspirational for me because I saw the signs like, I used to follow these guys in a big way because they sold out. And my aim always was to annoy enough of the big boys that one day they would just say, James, you know what, I'm just going to buy you and be done with it. But it never ended that way. You know, I kind of, I was ill for a period of time and I had... some employees in senior places in positions that really didn't give a monkeys, you know? And it's probably at the time when we went into voluntary liquidation, I just felt everybody else was to blame, you know? Ah, it was his fault. But ultimately, it was my fault. I hired the wrong people. I did the wrong stuff. You know, I must be the only idiot who goes and gets business coaching after his business has disappeared, you know? Because I wanted to work out what I did wrong.
So, no, I can completely resonate with that.
Mm.
That would bug me, not knowing what I've done wrong.
Yeah.
No, I can completely resonate. I reckon people will as well.
Yeah.
Because that's just the most frustrating thing, knowing that you've grown a monster.
Yeah.
And knowing the goal you want to achieve.
Yeah.
And not quite getting there. But then I suppose that went into your property business, which we'll talk about in a minute. But, yeah, sorry.
But it was a monster, you know. I used to say, late at night, I'd walk around the like warehouse floor and I think, how the hell did this happen? How did this happen? You know, and I used to, I remember taking my mum around there on the weekends or in the evenings. I still remember she used to come around and she used to love it. And she used to love seeing it. She'd always be having a go at me. Oh, you don't need to buy another machine. You don't need to do this. I'd be like, Mum, what do you know? Tell me what to do. And I think, you know, but secretly, I think she was really proud of it. You know, she'd be walking around and having a great old look. She, what's that then? What's this then? What's that then? But yeah, towards the end, it was, we lost some big accounts and, you know, I knew we wouldn't recover from it. And I think at that point, I kind of lost the love for it as well a little bit. So I remember we went into voluntary liquidation. We weren't forced into it. We put our hands up and said, look, you know what? I don't think we can recover from this. So we'll go into liquidation. And we owed the bank some serious amounts of money because you had finance.
Mm.
House was on risk, you know, everything was on risk. I just thought to myself, shit, how do I go home and explain to my wife that we could possibly be homeless here? But, you know, I managed to save the house, but it was still very embarrassing seeing those cars being driven up onto a trailer track at the workplace because we used to keep them there.
Mm.
And then, you know, when someone comes along with an official clipboard outside your house, starts looking at your car and then drives it away, people know something's happened, you know, people know your skin. And I didn't want to hide it. I thought, you know what? Okay, shit's hit the fan. The more, if I told one lie, I'd have to tell another. I just put my hands up and said, yeah, sorry, business went under. I nearly went homeless, you know. But again, remember when that disaster happened, there was two people that were there for me, which is my mum and my wife. And, you know, there was times when I just didn't know what I was going to do, where I was going to go. Because just, if anybody's ever been in that position where you've got debt and it's crippling debt, and you just don't know how you're going to get out of it, that's where suicide comes in, man.
Yeah, 100% agree.
That's where I can understand why people would do that, because there was times when I knew our business was going under, I remember being in the car, and I remember driving down the A13 in that bit just after, the bit near Tilbury where there's no cameras. I remember booting it thinking, all I need to do is hit this car into this central reservation, it's going to turn around and I'm going to kill myself.
Mm.
And I thought, but shit, what if I don't? What if I don't kill myself? What if I kill somebody else?
Mm.
And then I end up in prison. So all these things went through. But talking about suicide, I get it. 100% get it.
How much did you owe?
In the end, I owed about 2.3 million. I owed, personally. 2.3. Yeah. And then I managed to negotiate that down and down and down. in the end, I think I personally settled about £600,000 worth of it. And I've only just, I'd say only 6 months ago, I settled the last one. Because there was no way I was going to get out of this and just not settle it and go bankrupt and lose everything. I thought, no, I need to keep my credit rating because I'm in property. I need to keep this going because I'm doing this. So, yeah, I settled. I settled the bank debts because they're the ones that I needed to settle.
Was that through equity in other properties? Or
was... There was a little bit of refinancing, yeah. There was refinancing. There was doing deals, pulling money out here, setting up a few payment plans. But, yeah, I had to settle it.
Because I suppose, presumably, from the profits, you'd then invest that into property.
Yeah.
Is that where you first started?
When I was in the print game?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I was doing when I was in the print game, I was always dabbling in property. I might buy a flat. I might buy this. And then you might have heard me talk about this on the socials before. That was the only thing actually making me any solid money was the property, because you used to think, shit, I bought this for about 180 grand. And you look at it another year and you're like, oh, it's 225 now. Oh, it's gone up again. It's gone up again. But I never really took it seriously because I was always taking the print side seriously. But it was only when the business went under that I thought, okay, maybe I should take this seriously. And again, it was my wife who said, if everybody else can do it, you can do it. You know how this works. And just funny enough, we bought a plot of land. You might have seen it on the social. We bought a small plot of land between two houses. And I remember when we bought that, me and my business partner at the time, everyone was like, you guys are nuts. How are you going to build a house in a garden? And I think back now, yeah, maybe we were nuts, but we saw something that other people didn't see. We saw 12 planning applications that had been rejected. We could see what the council was going to give us. So we worked with them, and we got planning permission to build this house. But then me and my business partner went our separate ways. And my wife actually bought him out from the portion of land. So
okay.
My property business is run with my wife. She's just a silent partner who sits on the side. Signs a load of documents when we need stuff signing, but doesn't really get involved much. Half the time doesn't know what's going on with what we're doing, but she was the one who gave me the initial push to say, yeah, you can do this. And I'll never forget that. And we did. We went ahead and we built that house and it came out fantastic. So if anybody wants to see it, it's on the socials. It's a one-bedroom house in southwest London, which at the time everyone thought we were bonkers to do. But yeah, we pulled that one off, and I'll tell you a story about that. We had investment from my mother-in-law. So she invested into that deal for us. So she lent us the money to do the build work, or part of the money to do the build work. And then I raised some of the money myself. And I had no clue how build schedules work. I had no clue on vetting builders, nothing like that. And I lost £100,000. I lost £100,000 after liquidation. After liquidation, only 6 months after or 7 months after, and I had a hole in the ground with foundations that had been poured, and I'm looking at this thinking, okay, how do I go home and explain this one?
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, mate.
Because I didn't know about plans.
She's going to be screwing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I had to tell her because my wife can read me. She can read me very, very well. So lucky for us, we had one of our properties that we were able to refinance. Again, going back to refinancing, if you hold something long enough, it's going to go up, you know. Eventually, you'll have ups and downs. But we were able to refinance that property and complete that project. And yeah, and that's where it springboarded from. And, you know, I look back at that house now, and again, Lewis, it was the same kind of pains and sacrifices. You're thinking, is this going to value up?
Mm.
Fuck, why am I doing this? It's a one-bedroom house. And, you know, in the end, everyone's like, oh, James, why are you putting automation in it? Why are you putting speakers in it? Why have you got music in the showers? And I thought to myself, this house on this side is worth 1.2 million. This is worth 1.2 million. I want that little thing in the middle to be worth something serious as well. And, you know, it worked in my favour. It was. And this one little thing, this one-bedroom house is probably now in the region of 650 grand. You know, at the time it was 350. And it's growing. And you just think to yourself, if I hadn't taken a chance on this, where would I have been? If I just thought, all right, I've lost 100 grand. James, just give up. Go and get a job with someone and leave it. You know, just leave it. Don't do anything else.
I guess a lot of people are going to be asking, one, how did you raise the money? Obviously, you've approached your mother-in-law.
Yeah.
Two, there's so many loaded questions I can answer. How to find the right builder.
Yeah.
But we'll start with, I guess, the most important one is the build team? Because I would imagine, I know for a fact that you've run into a load of heat, well, a heap of shit with builders as of right. But how did you find the right build team for that project?
In the end?
Or most of your projects that you run now?
Right, so I'm really now, when you've been burnt once, if you get burnt a second time, you're just a dickhead. Simple as. If you get burnt once and you get burnt twice, then there's something seriously wrong, especially in the build game. So after that, I just went kind of, I went proper Sherlock Holmes on this shit. So I went, I put together a proper schedule. Right. First of all, not like, oh mate, can you build this for me? Here's the drawings now. Proper schedule.
So what does that consist of for people that don't know what it is?
So a proper schedule consists of every single stage you're going to go through on that build. Now, however stupid it might sound, like order skips, you know, that needs to go on your schedule. Put hoarding up on the site. All this stuff that doesn't really, it's not really going to affect the build, but it needs to go on the schedule, because I learned very early on, you cannot rely on assumption, because something I'm thinking might not be the same my builder's thinking. And something I'm trying to communicate to my builder might not be how he's taking it into his brain. Mm. So it's really, you just got to make it idiot-proof, you know? Do you remember those books back in the years? You have an idiot's guide to Microsoft Word or idiot's guide to
Excel,
this.
Yeah,
so it's literally an idiot guide. It breaks it down step by step by step. And if you see some of my build schedules now, they might have 700-800 lines on them. And like, oh, you're a bit extra, aren't you? No, I'm not a bit extra. I just don't want to lose 100 grand again. And I would always say, don't employ family, don't employ your friends, don't employ anybody that's close to you like that. You really want to employ someone you have no relationship with, but comes very highly recommended. And you need to go out and see people's work. Photos can lie. People are very good on Photoshop. You know, they'll show you. I've seen people show photos of their work, this angle. When you turn up the site, you look behind me, you're like, what the hell? You didn't show me this bit behind you. So definitely, when you're picking a builder, number one, go and see their work. Go and physically touch their work. Little tip for people I would also say is, ask them to provide you with 5 or 6 references with telephone numbers, and you randomly call them. Don't let him give you 1 or 2. Let them give you a list, and you randomly call them. And I'll call them all. I'll call them all, and I'll go around and have a look. And I'll also check the planning portals to see, has it been planning to build this extension or has it just been built? Because that in my head, then I'm thinking, okay, does the builder know what to do? Does the builder know that you need planning? Then I'll see, has building control been done on it? Has it been built safely? I'll give it a little kick, give it a little nudge, see if it's strong, if it's good. You know, all these little things, touch, feel, smell, look, taste if you wanna, you know, but go around there and really physically look at it. And then secondly, you need to know if you're gonna get on with this person, you know. If you're speaking to a builder and they're annoying you straight away, or they're making you feel lesser than them, I won't hire them. Because if the relationship's starting like that, how's it going to be when you're 6 months in? If you're always like, oh, Mr. Builder, so can you just do this? No, it's not in the schedule. You don't want someone speaking to you like that. So you've got to be able to communicate with your builder. And if it doesn't feel right in your gut, just don't do it. You know, do all the reference checks, do the credit checks, ask him for their bank statements. You want to see how your builder's running his day, you know. You don't want to be giving him money each month and he's down there on the online casinos out gambling it away, or he's buying stuff. Like my guy, he went and bought cars with the stuff, the money I gave him. You know, the first builder. This was a so-called friend from a gym.
Wow.
You know, someone I saw every single day. So you got to be very, very careful with builders. You can't just hand over money. And don't hand over chunks of money. Now, people that ring me, James, oh, gave him 30 grand on the first. I'm like, what? And what did he do for that? Oh, we just agreed that he's going to do the work. Oh, well, good luck. I hope he comes back on Monday, you know?
So you're going to ring their accountants to get the...
Absolutely. Yeah. Make sure they've got insurance.
Yeah.
Because if something goes wrong tomorrow, who are you claiming against? You know, ring up the insurance company and say, look, if he messes up, can I claim on his insurance? Because some of them won't let you.
Yeah.
So make sure all of these little things, and don't rush it. Don't rush it. You'd rather lose 2 weeks checking all this and hiring the right builder than just jumping straight in and, you know, hiring someone shit.
And I think it's important to recognise what you said there about boundaries between being a bit, making them your friend or bringing them too close within the friendship circle, because that's a line you don't want to cross.
Yeah.
I think with friendship and 100%. Colleagues.
Yeah.
I don't know what your thoughts on that.
No, absolutely, I agree with you. I made this mistake so many times. Like, I'm a naturally friendly person. I'd get too pally with the builder, you know, and then it becomes difficult to have a serious conversation with a builder. Because if you've been in a pub with him, you've had four or five pints and you've had a good night out, and then suddenly in the morning you've got a bollocking, it becomes difficult to bollock him. So I always say, your builder shouldn't be your friend. Yeah, be respectful, be nice to him. It's only now that my builder, who's done about five jobs this new team's done for me, only now will I have a beer with him because he understands me. And he always says to me, he goes, James, you're always shouting at me. He goes, you're always having a go at me. I go, you know what? I always shout and have a go at the people I love the most. And he's like, oh, well, you love me, yeah? Of course I do. But, you know, it takes time to get to that relationship. But early on, you should not. It needs to be strictly professional, because if you're gonna become pally with them and friendly with them, they're going to treat you in the same way. There's not going to be any boundaries and lines, like you said. You're going to literally be treading on eggshells at some point.
And then you went on to the HMOs.
Yeah.
Which you've raised a lot of money for.
Yeah.
So talk me through your HMO days. Not that you stopped, you're still doing them.
Yeah.
Because you've got your own coaching program as well.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You walk me through the HMO process and how you get the commercial valuation,
yeah.
Number one, because that confuses a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And what it takes to get the best out of the HMO world.
Okay, I think number one, you need to look at it as a business straight away. Mm. And you need to, I'll say number two, the number two biggest rule for me is you need to look at your tenants as clients and respect them, you know, because they're your customer. If you haven't got them, you haven't got business. The amount of people I hear saying, oh, my tenants this. I say, no. And I don't hear you complaining when you're out spending that money that your tenant's giving you. So treat them with respect, you know, have the highest level of respect for them and give them the best house you can, because they stay longer. You know, they stay for ages, they tell their friends about you. So respect your tenant is number one, and make sure you're treating this as a business. If you can get those two things right, I think then you're a winner. So with me, what happens is I realized very early on that I thought, yeah, this HMO game is pretty lucrative. It was more like a bedsit game back then, where it was just a house. They'd just have multiple people living there. You know, the word HMO didn't even exist then. It was just like bedsits, multiple lets or whatever it was. And I saw people doing it and I thought, oh, this looks pretty damn good, man. And then I realised what it was called later on when the council's cottoned on and started putting regulations in. And I really liked the model because it means you can get the maximum out of one property, you can get maximum out of rent. What would you rather have, one tenant or five tenants or eight tenants or 10 tenants? Because if three of them don't pay you, you've still got seven paying you, or however how many are paying you. So it becomes, you can manage your risk a little bit better with them. But for me, I always look for a house that is pretty big to start with. Because if it's big to start with, you got a lot of room to play with. Now, I know that's not always easy. So you can put loft extensions on, you can put rear extensions on, you could do all that business. But it's important for me to find something that's got the right foundation, the right gubbins to start with. And then generally what we tend to do is put a 3 meter extension on, so it's all within permitted. We can do an extension within permitted. I try to keep within what I can do because I don't want to be waiting around for planning. And I always have en suites, always, because I think when somebody comes around and sees a room with their own ensuite, it's a game changer. You know, it really is. People look at it and they think, yeah, I'm taking that room because it's just like, yeah, I've got my own bathroom. Even if I don't get on with anybody else in the house, I've still got my own space. You know, I can be my own person in my own space. And I think the other thing, very important thing with HMOs is creating the co-living, you know.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, they say, oh, yeah, I create co-living spaces. No, you don't, mate. You've got eight rooms where people just sit in their room and you've got one tiny little galley kitchen where they go to cook their food. Or you might be one of those guys that puts a fridge in the room and has a microwave. And I just think to myself, nah, I wouldn't want to do that. For me, my kitchens are always big. They're always quite extravagant. They're always the most expensive part of the house because I want people going there. I want people having a relationship. And it's a prime example that thinking works, because if I go to any of our London HMOs where there's established relationships now, that's exactly what happens. On a Friday night, if I walk in there, I know four or five of the girls are going to be sitting in the kitchen. One's going to be cooking. They're going to have a glass of wine on. The music's going to be on. And it's so nice to see that, because I think to myself, this is how I want you to live. And I always say to my tenants, like, oh, I want you to thrive in my place. I don't want you to come here and think, oh, man, this place is shit. I want you to come here and think, you know what, my landlord's so good. I complained about this and it was fixed the same day. Or we had an issue with this and it was fixed the same day. Because I can tell you right now, as a business owner, if your tenant's one day late on their rent, you're screwing. You know, you didn't give them no leeway. So you need to give people the same respect. You need to show them, like, look, anything goes wrong, I'm here for you. We have WhatsApp groups where they communicate. You know, anything goes wrong, they put it in the WhatsApp group. I'm in there, maintenance guy's in there, a local handyman's in there. So someone's always picking something up. And for me, if there's an issue, I want to deal with it straight away because I don't want that issue to become a major issue and damage this place that I've spent quite a lot of money on, you know. So always make sure you're treating them with respect. And then I guess lastly is what you were saying was getting the valuation right. Now, I think for that, it's very important that you got the right finance guys. There's a lot of finance guys out there, and I think there's a very small amount of finance guys that actually talk the talk. There's a lot of people that talk shit, you know, and I've seen it. They can get you this product, they can do this, they can do that. When it comes to the crunch, some of them don't even want to look at your case. They think, why are you wasting my time? You know, oh, you haven't submitted me all the documents. Say, listen, you know I've got all the documents. Just tell me what I need. Tell me, is this going to work or not? And that's the very reason why I always find myself coming back to my day one broker, who was my friend, and he runs a wealth management company. He's not on social media anywhere because he doesn't need to be, because they've got so much business that they don't need to be promoting for new business. And he kind of generally laughs at some of the posts I put up, because if I ever go and see him, I might take a picture of his Ferrari. I was like, and I put a post up a few months ago saying, does your broker drive a Ferrari on a Friday afternoon? And I had so many brokers message me. And then I saw him a few days later and I said, does he drive a Porsche on a Wednesday? And he is literally like that, you know. And I find it's very important from day one to have that relationship with a broker, because he's going to be the person who's going to advise you, or she's going to be the person who advises you if you can do these deals. And my broker, you know, he keeps me calm in certain situations. Like typical, our current HMO, we've gone over the bridge time. You know, yeah, we've been fined. Actually, today's the last day. Ironically enough, today's the last day. So they want their 1.5% extra and they want their extra interest. And my broker said to me, he goes, James, you know, you've had really good wins as well. So if we have a little fuck up now and again, just deal with it. You know, just pay it, get it done. And I think that's where a good broker comes in. So he not only manages your deals, but emotionally he keeps you stable, because you know what this game's like, man.
Yeah.
You're waiting around for valuations. You're waiting around for this to happen. You're waiting around for, you know, the banks to process stuff and it's not going through. So I think a broker becomes like, for me, broker's number one. Definitely.
I think that's great advice for anyone listening. So if you could give anyone listening the piece of advice, in fact, no, a better question would be, what's the best piece of advice you've received?
Best piece for, in terms of property?
In general.
Numbers don't lie, people do.
Powerful.
Yeah, numbers don't lie, people do. And that's exactly what I tell people, man. Just look at the numbers. They're not going to lie to you. There's no emotions involved with numbers. If you're talking to a person, they can twist it the way their tone is, the way their voice is. So that's number one advice. Numbers don't lie, people do.
Is that in property or are you talking
about... Just generally, all over. Absolutely. You know, the numbers are there. You can't change them. Well, you could fudge them if you wanted to, but generally...
There's no point.
No, the numbers ain't going to lie. People will... Your emotions will lie. Your own brain will tell you this deal looks like a deal. Your heart will tell you this deal looks like a deal. You'll get involved in it emotionally, but just put that aside. Look at the numbers. Are the numbers telling you what you need to see? Don't manipulate the numbers. Just look at the numbers.
And how am I as a new investor... How am I supposed to get started in acquiring my first HMO?
I guess every person who has a coaching program will probably say, "Oh, come and sign up for my coaching program." But I'm not going to say that.
Plug.
I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say, do you know what? There's a lot of education out there that you can go to. And one of the reasons why I started my own coaching program was because so many people were contacting me and saying, James, I need advice on this. I need advice on this. I need advice on this. I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to put together a course. It's about 40-odd hours. It's all been recorded by myself. And it just takes you on the journey from the very beginning, from sourcing to refinancing and letting to your tenants. And every single thing in between there. There's videos in there of every fuck-up I've done. And I talk about it openly. I talk about losing money. It's not a polished course in the sense where it's like, oh, we do this. Oh, it's all design-led, it's all this nonsense. I hate it when people say, oh, HMO is all design-led. And I see all these people getting their HMOs Instagram ready. And sometimes you don't need that. You don't need that shit. Look, at the end of the day, it's all good posting these nice pictures of your HMO looking very sexy, but if it's sat there empty and you're having to give it to a housing association, what's the point? Create it for your client. You know, create that HMO for the client type you've got. Fuck Instagram, because people are there just like, oh, I put these lovely pillows on it. Look at this feature wall. It's bollocks. Absolute nuts. Create the product that people want. So, yeah, I would say if anybody seriously wanted to get into HMOs, yeah, I think my program's great because it's raw like me. It's going to tell you what you need to hear. It's not going to tell you crap like, oh, do this, do that. It is literally step by step, and it goes through every single thing, you know. And that's partly the reason why I recorded it, was because so many people were asking for help.
And where can people find that?
Yourhmocoach.com. Yeah.
Wicked. It will be in the description. I'll put that in there. So if anyone wants to reach out. No, mate, that's not a problem. I highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. I'm going to ask you a few questions. Sure. I've got them written down. So what are the top three questions that you wish you received as a child in school?
Top three questions? What, somebody asked me, a teacher?
Yeah, as a teacher. If someone could guide you as a child in school, what do you think them questions should be? Or what do you think your kids should receive a question about as a career? So for me, I wanted to be a PE teacher.
Sure.
But knowing that the cap was, say, 40, 50 grand,
yeah.
I wish someone would ask me a different question of, this is the cap. What about expanding your horizon and looking at X, Y, and Z?
Sure, sure.
So what would that be for yourself?
I think it would have been good if a teacher asked me what my dream was.
Yeah.
What are your dreams? What do you want to do? Not what do you want to be, what are your dreams? Like, as in, go crazy. Tell me what you want to be. If you want to be a flipping astronaut, tell me you want to be an astronaut. Giving me that kind of thinking outside of the box. I think schools are very, very limited in their thinking. And do you know what? If it was up to me, I'd probably pull my kids out of school. In the sense that, okay, maybe not in Dubai because it's a little bit different, but here, I can't believe when I was a teacher, people are 16, 17, 18 in college, they don't know what flipping mortgage is. They say, oh, I want to buy a Ferrari, but they don't understand how much money you'd need to buy a Ferrari, or they want to buy this house, they don't understand how much money you need. There's no money education. People don't teach you about money. And I think that's so important. Why are you teaching my kid about trigonometry? He's not going to go out and learn about trigonometry, is he? He needs to know how the world works. He needs to know what a check is. In this day and age, they need to know what digital currency is. They need to know what they can invest in. They need to know about, you know, passive income coming in, multiple streams of income. They need to know all of this stuff, but it's still so old-fashioned. I think the schooling system, number one, needs to be changed. And I think if I could go back, I wish somebody had asked me, what is your dream? What do you dream about? You know, be a dreamer.
The reason I asked you that is obviously, one, being a teacher, being a qualified teacher. I've not asked anyone that question. And obviously having young kids, I think it's exactly what you've just said there.
Yeah.
Obviously we're in a recession now. We've not even touched on that. I think we could just do a whole podcast on a recession.
Yeah.
What's going to come of that? What are you implementing now in your own business to surround, like, bulletproof yourself, if you like? But again, what you've just touched on there, for myself, I'd say exactly the same to my kids. This is what you need to be looking at now, and in investing investing in yourself. Dream bigger. But
I think people need to stop saying no to kids as well.
Yeah.
When they're younger, because kids are born with no fear. You see them, they'll be ready to jump off a flipping, you know, flight of stairs when they're like 5-6 months, when they just learn to walk. We're like, oh, no, don't do this. I'm not saying let your kid jump off a flight of stairs, but what I'm saying is, don't restrict their thinking. People restrict children's thinking.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, they put them in this box where it's just like, oh, man, he don't want to do this. He doesn't want to do this. He's not thinking for himself anymore. He's scared of things. And I know we do it to protect our children, but I think you need to stop saying no to children and say to them, yeah, you know what? You can be a flipping A1 basketball player, or you can go to the NBA, or you know what? You can be a Premiership footballer, but this is what you need to do to get there.
There's going to be sacrifice.
Yeah.
And it's the snowflake mentality, but that's no disrespect. I think that's just what we have created. Not necessarily us, but certain people have created in society, but not a lot of people can do what you've done, for example. Lose that amount of money, come out the other end of it saying that this is what I've now created.
Yeah.
Not many people have got that left in them, whereas now they sit on their phone on Instagram. Like you said about the HMO, the most common thing I see, again, with serviced accommodation, because that's the game I'm in, it's got to look better before you've actually dressed it for the guest. Is it guest ready?
Mm.
And in your case, is it client ready?
Yeah.
No, it's not. You're just posing for Instagram.
Yeah.
So actually, on SA, are you against SA? Just slightly off topic.
I'm not against SA. I used to be, you know what? I used to think SA was very much just a job. And I think if you're managing it yourself, it is a job.
It is.
If you're single-handedly doing it yourself, it's a job. I used to think rent-to-rent was a bit of a waste of time. But I think, I now realise, I thought it's a waste of time if you're just there without a model, without systems, without processes, because you're just a busy fool. But with SA, I think SA is very, very lucrative, you know, if it's done correctly, if you've got the right systems in place. You only have to look at some of the guys doing really well from it. You know, in Dubai, the firm that I'm working with, they have a company called PrimeStay, and they're one of the biggest SA companies in Dubai. And like you said, Liz, if you go around to look at some of their units, they're not swanky units, but you've got 85, 87% occupancy in these things, in the most lucrative place in the world. And they're making some serious money.
Yeah, honestly, so, it's one of the... What people can't understand is with serviced accommodation, it's a service.
Yeah.
But they're just looking at these programs and courses and going, I need the money now. It's a quick fix. It's chasing that shiny penny. And what you touched on with, again, being guest ready, client ready, not a lot of people can wait that long until they see the return on their sort of time or investment.
I think if you're in SA, you need to have a plan with what you're doing with that money. You can't just be taking that money and buying Rolexes and having a good time. No. You should do a little bit of that. But
yeah, eventually. But again, like what you said, it's a business.
Yeah.
And any model that you choose in property, buy-to-lets, HMO, it's a business.
Yeah.
You've got to have an exit. And I don't think a lot of people do.
Yeah.
They're going to follow someone on Instagram or someone that's created a program. I'm going to follow them, buy a load of houses. It doesn't happen. And to be honest, it's fucking boring.
Yeah.
It's absolutely, it's one of the most boring things I've ever done. Whereas if you look into, not saying this is what you should do, it's not financial advice, crypto and learn about digital currency, I find that more fascinating.
Yeah.
Like M&A, I find that a lot more interesting than buying a house.
Yeah.
Fucking deal with solicitors all day or be on the phone to utility companies.
Yeah.
Then you'll change your mind about buying houses. I mean... It's just not going to be on the phone all day.
You know what, like, coming back to SA, you just have to look at some of the guys that do really well. You know, you've got guys that do really, really well from it, and they've got such a wicked, like, they've got such a, their social profile's just so cool. You look at it, you think, oh, man, this guy's living his life, or the guys are living their life. And then you look at other people that are doing it in a big way, and they're just, you know, they're just walking around with their dog, just chilling. Well, you know, Kabir, for example, he's been on my podcast, you've probably heard of Kabir.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's proper undercover, this guy. You look at him and you just think this guy's some homeless hobo if you saw him on the street. And I've said this to him before, but he is so clever. I think he's a child genius. You know, he knew school wasn't for him. And you look at some of the deals this guy's involved in, we're not talking one or two essays, we're talking blocks.
Oh yeah.
The guy has blocks now. But he could walk you past the street and you think, oh, who's this guy, man, walking his dog, some homeless dude. He's got that whole profile. He don't want people to know he's flossing. But he's got a game, you know, I'm sure he's got, I don't know if he's what he's doing with it, but I'm sure he's got a good game plan.
So I'm just talking about him. What he's done really well is he's built a foundation, which not a lot of people can do.
Yeah.
And so that foundation, where he's located, being obviously in and around the London area, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And because one, the occupancy is higher, but he's not worrying about other people, and that's what so many people do.
I love that about him, yeah.
He don't give a shit about anyone else.
Yeah.
He will actually congratulate them if they book someone else's property rather than his, because he's not worried.
Yeah.
He's just constantly staying in his own lane.
He's got a great system, he's got a great process, and he is a really nice guy. I've, you know, been on the podcast, met him a few times.
Yeah.
And like you say, I really do think he does not give a flying monkeys about anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, which is a great place to be, because you spend so much time worrying about what everybody else is doing, that you know, before you know it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you're like, shit, I haven't done nothing.
Yeah, I completely agree, mate. What's the biggest thing you've been wrong about in the last year?
Ooh, biggest thing I've been wrong about. Crypto.
What do you mean?
In the sense that, I know it's down at the moment, but I wish I'd listened to my 12-year-old son when he was saying to me, when Bitcoin was like 1,000 or 2,000 or something, and ETH was just kicking off, and this is my son, 12 years old, getting his source of information is TikTok. And I was like, nah, this is just bollocks. I'm not listening to a word you say. And even now, he says to me, Dad, he goes, you know, if you'd listened to me back then, he goes, you wouldn't need to be doing what you're doing now. You could be chilling. So, yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things I was wrong about, was not listening to him.
Fucking hell. A grand. It's not too late, though.
Yeah.
It's not too late.
Every time I touch crypto, I lose money. I give up with it. But, you know, on that point, don't disregard what your children say, because children are clever people.
Yeah.
You know, don't matter what age they are. Like, I'm one of those people, I'll learn from anybody. If you're 5 years old, if you're 10 years old, you're 50 years old, I want to soak up information. I love soaking up information. I love learning from people. And I don't disregard what people say. If somebody says to me, oh, you know, the Earth's square, or it's a cube, I think, is it? Let's explore it a little bit more. You know, so I think there's value from every person you meet.
I love that you just said that. There's definitely something to take from that. From everyone that's listening, there's opportunity everywhere, and from everything that someone says.
Yeah.
And you've got to learn, absorb as much content, everything that you possibly can.
Yeah.
And learn.
Yeah.
That doesn't cost you anything, apart from, you've got to pay for it.
Yeah.
And that's an advanced level, but you just learn as much as you possibly can.
You know when your 12-year-old comes to you and he's put a stupid video on TikTok about a flying balloon, a helium balloon, and he goes, look at that, 1.2 million views. I told you I know what social's all about. And you're like, okay, maybe you're onto something. Maybe you can help me.
Wait, that's ridiculous. We're trying to get like 5 views on a podcast, isn't it?
On a flying helium balloon in the sky. It's got the right music on it and it's been tagged correctly, but it's just his point of saying, look, it's as easy as that, Dad, if you listen.
Oh, that's ridiculous. What's the best, I've already asked you, the best piece of advice you've received? Your biggest failure?
I think my biggest failure is not looking in the mirror and realising that everything that's gone wrong was actually my fault. You know? Everything that has gone wrong is because of me. I can't ever blame anybody else. And it took me a long, long time to realise that everything that goes right is because of me, and everything that goes wrong is because of me. So I think my biggest failure is probably not looking at myself and saying, you know what, this is actually you and nobody else. In a weird kind of way.
That's powerful. And then I guess your biggest regret, to follow on from that.
What is my biggest regret? I think looking back now, when I knew the business was in trouble, knowing what I know now, I could have saved it. I could have saved it. You know, like you say, with mergers and acquisitions, talking to different people, raising money through financing kit, you know, I could have saved it. So I think that's a regret that always niggles at me a little bit, because I could have saved it and sold it, because I could have sold it. You know, that's one thing I could have done, is sold it. All right, it may have not sold for, because you've lost some clients, but it's a great foundation for someone. But I just, yeah, that's one of my biggest regrets. That kind of bugs me. Every so often that bugs me. I think, if that was still around, yeah.
There's nothing stopping you now.
Ah, no, mate.
Solo press around the corner.
No, I'm done.
What's one thing that you know that others don't?
One thing that I know that others don't. God, this is a good question, man. It's a very good question. That my family will always have my back no matter what. Yeah, my wife will always have my back. She'll say to me, I told you so. She'll make me feel small about it, but when shit hits the fan, I know my family have always got my back. And to be fair, that's the only people I really need in my circle, and a few good friends. That's it.
Wicked, man. And the last one, are you okay?
Am I okay?
Yeah.
That's a good question, Lewis. I am okay, mate. You know, for the first time, I am okay, because it's really weird when, as soon as I moved to Dubai, I met this psychologist called Dr. Anand. He's actually got a big following on Instagram. And I had some personal one-to-one sessions with this guy. And our firm, where we are, this company that I'm working with, they're very much about psychology, about training, and really giving you all the resources to succeed. And one of the things he said, which is so powerful, was if you're going into a situation, you got to be going into the situation massively positively and talking out loud. So today, I'll give you an example. I thought to myself, you know what, I've been stressed about this valuation for a while. And I said to myself, fuck it. And I shouted out in my car, I said, I'm going to this valuation, I'm going to get exactly what figure I want to get, so I get this deal done. And it just changed my whole thinking, you know. I walked into there thinking, shit, yeah, I've got what I wanted to get, you know. And I think speaking out loud and manifesting stuff positively, waking up in the morning and saying, you know what, I'm going to have a fucking awesome day today. Ain't nobody going to make my day shit, no matter what's going on. Because your brain don't know what's real and what's fake, you know. And once you figure out that this little thing inside, look, think about it. Your brain's in a black box, yeah? It don't see shit. Your eyes are telling your brain what you want to see. So you could look at something beautiful and tell your brain everything is beautiful. Your brain only gets sound through your ears, so you can listen to something great and give your brain that positive. You know, you speak positive words and your brain absorbs those. So for me, the biggest thing for me is every morning getting up and just saying, today's going to be a fucking awesome day. Because it could be your last day, you know. You don't know if you're coming back home from work. Could be the last time you kiss your wife or kiss your kids. So I want to go out my house thinking I'm going to have an awesome day today, even if I know certain things in my day are going to be shit. But for me, I'm not going to let those get in the way. So yeah, start your day with mad positivity. Get out of your bed and shout it. Shout it out the window.
I completely agree with that, mate. And on that, so if you could leave your kids one message, your family one message, to end the podcast with, what would it be?
You're capable of doing anything you want to do. That's wicked. My message. You're capable, and don't let anybody tell you that you can't do it, because you can.
James, thank you so much for coming on.
No worries,
it's been an absolute pleasure. Guys,
so
I'm going to put all the links to James's social media channels, the course, the HMOcoach.com. And
do you know what I'm going to do? If anybody comes through from Lewis's podcast on that course, you know what? I'm actually going to give it to you for half price.
James, so thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, mate. Yeah, appreciate it.
Thank you. Done.
Thank you for listening to the Connect You podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share this on your socials, tag me, and leave a review.